On January 10th, 2013, 500 people gathered on Dalhousie campus to hear a panel of speakers discuss the issues surrounding the international Idle No More movement. Presented by Solidarity Halifax and Idle No More, this evening of education, action, and ceremony shared information and analysis on the economic and political structures that have and continue to shape a colonial relationship between First Nations and Aboriginal peoples and the Canadian state. Speakers for the evening included Marina Young, Rebecca Moore, and Taylor Paul from Idle No More, Billy Lewis, an Aboriginal elder and community leader, Megan Leslie, Halifax MP and NDP environment critic, Dr. Aaron Wunker, Canadian Studies Coordinator at Dalhousie University, Sebastian LaBelle from Solidarity Halifax, and Patricia Doyle, a professor with Dalhousie who specializes in law, Aboriginal studies, and their transition year program. Before recording started, Marina Young and Rebecca Moore spoke passionately about the importance of treaty rights and protected lands, showcasing the loss of culture and tradition Bill C-38 and 45 would bring about. We'll start now with Taylor Paul, local artist and Idle No More activist, and Aaron Wunker, professor of English and Canadian Studies, who spoke of the history of colonialism in Canada.
I have no access to my reserve land. My parents weren't available to me. Nothing. I was left with nothing. I lived on the streets, I ate garbage, I walked for miles and miles with nowhere to go. And I found spirituality, and that's what got me through, and that's the only thing I was left with. So when people... people don't seem concerned about the waters, and I've been not able to reintegrate with my community that is on my status card because of pollution to the waters, I find it really hard to swallow when people tell me it's for economic gain, when people tell me that they can make a bit of money off of it because I'm thinking that I'm their next generation, that my story is going to be their children, because my family's been here for three generations in Halifax, and I know what it's like to be disconnected from culture, from things that you identify with, from being left with nothing. I was put in a place that was other from society. I wasn't integrated into society. I was put in a place that was other from society, and it was up to me to pick up the pieces. And that's a lot of what culture is right now, from colonialism. It's a lot of picking up the pieces. It's a lot of reading and researching to figure out what the hell you're about, because you're not other, you're one of people that's being stripped of culture in a variety of different ways through a variety of different strategies by the Canadian government. So it's my realization that the Canadian government's never represented Aboriginal people. I would challenge anyone to say otherwise. And then we could talk about it some more.
There are a lot of y'all here. You don't see that from facing me in the direction. I'm honored to be sharing a podium with so many wise, articulate, caring people. And I'm especially glad to see so many of you who I don't know who have made the time to come out tonight, so thank you for that. My name is Erin Wunker. I teach in the Department of English here at Dalhousie, and I direct the Canadian Studies program. And I'm pretty thrilled to see so many people that I think are students in the audience. Okay, like Taylor, I have been set with the task of discussing and addressing the history and effects of colonialism in Canada. And though Taylor and I tried really hard to get together, we didn't. But I think actually we probably did connect somehow, because what I have to say to you buttresses nicely, I think, to what she said. I'm going to speak to you from my position as a professor of literature, right? Meaning that I'm going to talk to you about a couple of terms. I'm going to talk about three things: settler colonialism, narrative representation, and unlearning. And Taylor has already started us on the process of unlearning. Additionally, I'm going to suggest to you some of the ways that I see Idle No More modeling and creating collaborative and coalitional space for acknowledging the damaging effects of colonialism, as well as moving forward in productive and generative ways. But I can only start to speak to you about the colonial history and its lasting effects by first acknowledging my own position. I am non-Aboriginal. I have settler colonial ancestry, meaning that I benefited from colonialism long before I understood what that word meant. I'm also speaking to you as someone who's trained as a literary and cultural studies scholar who conducts her teaching and research in the fields of Canadian literary and cultural production, meaning I think about the way that stories circulate. I think about the work that stories do, the way that they can move from stories, subjective accounts, into history, seemingly inscrutable facts, or in the opposite direction, the way that they can move from facts into stories. You've all been given a handout prepared by the Good People of Solidarity Halifax that Taylor started to walk us through already. It's a clear and, as they note on the top of it, partial chronology of some of the historical colonial events in this region specifically, beginning with the arrival of Europeans, or what we might refer to more accurately as first contact between the people who lived here and the people who came to live here. What I want to do with the time that I have is not to work through those dates, to acknowledge them, right? But more so to think about the ways that historical events have been narrativized, put into story, and the way that those stories have moved into dominant understandings of Canada's colonial history. So to do that, I'm going to move to those three terms that I mentioned to you. First, I think it's probably useful to understand what settler colonialism means. You may have seen it as a meme on the internet. I'm going to break it down into an actual definition. When I use the term settler colonialism, I'm referring to the particular kind of colonial history that a country like Canada has. At its most basic, colonialism can be defined as a practice of domination, which involves the subjugation of one people to another. There are many different kinds of ways that colonialism is enacted, and Canada was forged predominantly through settler colonialism. Settler colonialism occurs when colonial powers relocate settlers from the home country, France and Britain predominantly, into the colonized lands. These settlers leave their homes permanently, and they tend to act as occupiers. They develop a sense of difference from their home country, sometimes forgetting or losing their awareness of their settler status. I don't always and didn't initially identify or understand that my history was settler colonial, in other words. Indeed, this forgetting or loss of awareness over time is part of the role that narrative plays. Rather than remembering and teaching Canadians about colonial history, narrative gets inverted, distorted, and often the narrative becomes simply and egregiously wrong. A small example, 2009, Prime Minister Stephen Harper told an international audience of G20 members that Canada, and I quote, has no history of colonialism. The second concept I want to introduce is a way of thinking about how settler colonial history has shaped narratives and relationships fundamentally between First Nations peoples and Canadian relationships is the concept of narrative representation, or how stories work. Narrative means story. It's the aestheticized version of an account or events. Narrative representation, and in settler colonial nations, narrative representation in settler colonial nations can represent or function as a tool to facilitate this historical forgetting. Like historical events and statements such as the Prime Minister's disavowal of Canada's colonial history, these circulate as damaging and pernicious narratives. They augment other long-standing narrative representations of Canada, Canadians, First Nations. A couple of examples, right? We see them show up in seemingly innocuous places like beer ads. As my students will groan and know because I've stated this, I think, maybe twice in the last 24 hours, narratives of Canada as a vast and empty wilderness do more than convey images of awe-inspiring nature. They also subtly reinforce founding narratives of this land as unpopulated prior to the arrival of Europeans. And this, in turn, serves to justify settler colonial occupation, and aggressive assimilation policies that emerged as the Canadian government's official stance towards people, First Nations people. And here's the thing about stereotypes, right? If you're not the one being misrepresented by them, then they don't require you to think or work to understand their history or context or your complicity with them. They translate into simplistic, incorrect, sensationalistic, or misleading narratives. So narrative has long played a role in the formation of Canadian national consciousness, and it's done so in a settler colonial fashion through the willful forgetting of colonial history. Narrative has the power to damage, certainly. And narrative has played a damaging role in Canadian and First Nations relations, understanding of one another's stories, even conversation, right? I firmly maintain that narratives and narrative tropes have power. They have the power to do incredible and long-lasting damage. But that isn't the only role that narratives can or should play. Narratives and the language that constructs them also have incredible power to fight against stereotypes, to address unjust histories and relationships. And so the last term I want to offer you tonight is the concept of unlearning. Unlearning means to acknowledge that something that you thought was true is actually untrue, such as false or partial histories, damaging narrative representations that become dominant discourses and stereotypes. So you have to acknowledge them first, and then you have to actively work to address, acknowledge, and change your understanding of the facts. And settler colonial history, ancestry people like me, I'm talking to you, right? Because First Nations people know their stories, or are learning them, or are doing the work to learn them. I am part of a population that has been told I have always had a right to be here, and that is simply untrue. Unlearning would also require, right, that we non-Aboriginal allies learn to be allies by educating ourselves, not just about settler colonial histories, but also about how we read mainstream narratives. Like, for example, doing the work to find out how financial relationships between the government and First Nations actually work, rather than saying, hey, is that new budget, the audit of Attawapiskat, isn't that damning? Right? It would actually mean that we have to unlearn knee-jerk reactions, such as asking where all the government money goes. Unlearning means undertaking hard critical work. It might mean thinking about the timing of the Deloitte Touche audit. It might require understanding that that audit began 5 years before Theresa Spence became chief. Unlearning means that those of us with settler colonial histories need to work very hard indeed to recognize our own complicities in this narrative of nation. So finally, to Idle No More and my relationship to it. In my view, Idle No More is an incredible model for facilitating unlearning, for working together to acknowledge the past, the present, and to work together for an equitable future for all of us living here on Turtle Island. No. Idle No More is a grassroots movement that invites models of productive unlearning of these damaging narratives. And the Idle No More movement also makes space for and asks that allies acknowledge the power of narrative both to marginalize and divide people and to move forward. In order to move forward into a collaborative relationship built on mutual respect, we need to learn each other's stories and unlearn the dominant discourses of them. We need to value each other's narratives and narrative strategies. And in doing this work, at least on the part of a fourth generation settler colonial like myself, this requires acknowledging that not only do I have much to learn, I have a hell of a lot to unlearn too. Thanks.
Next, Billy Lewis shares some history of Aboriginal activism and his thoughts on the proposed bills.
I know in the last few days I've been having a heck of a time, because every time I would make some notes like I just did, along would come something else, and it would completely change whatever the heck I'd written. And to keep up with those clowns in Ottawa is a chore in itself. The moment that you think you've got them, they move the goalposts. And that can be confusing, but if you look at it in the right way, or you go down deep and look at what they're about, then all of a sudden it comes into focus. And if we have our focus as Indigenous grassroots people, and we do what we need to do, then we can change not only ourselves, as was just mentioned, but change the government and the world, because that's where the answer comes from. It doesn't come from on high, it comes from us. So if it's high, it's high in spirit, not in government. When I was looking at all the things that I wanted to share here today, I realized that we can learn a lot from history. We can learn a lot from what we've done. In fact, I remember my first response to Idle No More. I said, Idle? 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 Who do they call an idol? I've been at this 40 years. What the hell are they talking about? I realized it was four sisters in Saskatoon speaking to their young constituency, the whatever society, that they were speaking to a constituency that they wanted to get up off their butts. And so I'm not the last speaker here. Patty still has to come up. But what I want to address is not just that history, which I would suggest that everyone go home, dig into the, well, for one, go to the Idle No More site, and you'll see there, I think it was there, but God knows, I'm not too computer savvy, I keep getting all this stuff and don't remember where I got it from, but there was a thing with Russ Dibble, wrote a whole big, long thing, because he's a policy person who used to be with the Brotherhood, and then later with the AFN as a policy person, and he gave the whole history from Chrétien's white paper right up to today, and the relationship between Indigenous people and the Crown. And there's so much to learn there, and as well, I read something else by a book out there by Gord Hill, in fact I just picked it up, and I worked with him out west when I worked in the downtown east side in Vancouver. And he speaks about that history as well, and speaks about what should be done about it, and speaks about it from the point of view mostly of the leaders, and quite frankly, the misleaders. I think what was missed a bit here is we're talking about colonialism and the effects of that. But one of the effects is, what there's a name for it, and it's called neocolonialism. And that's where our own people are acting and organizing in a manner that reflects the colonial powers' ways of doing things. Like, we have ways of doing things, not in a hierarchical, pyramidal way, but in a circle. We got half of a circle here today. But anyway, where we do things in a circle where there's that equality. And that's a different way of organizing, it's a different way of seeing than the way that we have imposed upon us. So, when we go away today, I would ask, like I understand there's a couple meetings coming up in the next little while where there'll be further discussion, because it would have been preferable to share some of this stuff today and then all of us sit around and discuss it, but we can't in a crowd this size. But go home and learn the things that were brought up tonight. Keep an eye, watch, because believe me, in the next 2 or 3 days you'll have many opportunities to see how colonialism and neocolonialism works, because you'll see it right there in Ottawa, because I'll tell you quite frankly, I don't expect anything except another bunch of promises and another bunch of put-offs to some future date that's going to come out of what's going to happen in the next few days in Ottawa. That's my expectation. So it's very important that not just the old farts have been in this for a number of years, but everybody has to get out there and learn the things that we need to learn.
as was said, and I remember that one from a long time ago, you have to unlearn. Mm-hmm. You know, that's an old Sufi teaching, by the way. To unlearn is more important than learning. And so if we can do that together, then, you know, quite frankly, there's more of us than there are of them. And I'm struck by the irony. I don't know if anybody else noticed it. I wrote it in my book a couple days ago. But take a look at what these two bills are called. C-38, C-45, those are guns that are being held at our head. And that there's nothing they can do about those guns if all of the idle, no more people and all of us surround them. You can't, with a six gun, you can't shoot everybody. I don't want to sound like I'm giving the answer, but I think I am. What it's going to take is it's going to take all of us taking a stand. I was just at ceremonies up in St. Mary's here during the summer, and what came out of those ceremonies, it was to bring the Wabanaki Confederacy, all the peoples of the Eastern Doorway, together. And believe it or not, on the last day of those ceremonies, they invited all the allies in, and there were just as many allies showed up as our participants that took part during that whole time. And there was a lot of discussion and a little fumbling and some, well, we better pass a motion and do this and do that. Well, that quickly got squashed. And so what happened is that as a result of that confusion for a while, people kind of summarized and came to something that made so much sense that I think it's true to this day. And what came of it was the necessity, they said, like there was in the old days, in the prairies especially, they used to stick a stake or a spear or something in the ground, tie it to their leg, and stand there with their arms crossed and say, "Here we stand." And that's what we have to do. Take that stake, drive it right through colonialism, neocolonialism, or what have you, and say, "Here we stand, no more. We're not taking any more, and we're not going to appeal to you with a cup in our hand," or you know, I don't want to knock Chief Spence, but to me, you don't appeal to someone that doesn't have a conscience. Just stand where you are and say who you are, then they have to respond.
Sebastian LaBelle, a member of Solidarity Halifax, links the Idle No More movement with their philosophies of allyship and anti-capitalism.
Hi, everyone. Before I get started with what I had to say, Megan just slipped me a note just earlier in response to something Aaron said earlier. So I'll just read this note. Sebastian. Aaron talking about where did all the government funding go? If this is helpful, ... And I think it is, because I read the note. Old numbers from 2004. Federal funding to First Nation peoples works out to about $7,200 per person for health, education, roads, etc., etc. If you take the funding for a non-First Nations person in Ottawa, it varies by municipality, it's about $14,900. So about double the funding per person for a non-First Nations person in comparison to First Nations. So that's indicative of the discrepancy that and inequality that exists in our society and our relationship. Thank you all for coming. It's great to have such a large crowd here. And we're all gathered here today because of how passionate we feel about this issue or how interested we are in better understanding it. So first I'd like to explain why Solidarity Halifax supports Idle No More. We support Idle No More because it's an expression of rage. It's an act of defiance, expressed in many ways against yet another example in the Canadian state's long legacy of colonialism, arrogance, and paternalism towards the Indigenous peoples of this land. Idle No More is a rightful stand against the degradation of the territorial rights of Indigenous peoples, against the latest attempt to privatize reserve land in all commonly held territories. And it is also against the latest example in a long history of efforts to force Indigenous peoples to assimilate into a system of private property, wage labor, and profit accumulation. So, many of us are here today gathered because we see common ground in a fight against the Harper government and the omnibus bills. And this common ground is very important, and it must serve to give us strength and the ability to work towards a common goal. However, there are two things that we need to keep in mind in this effort. First, as Aaron alluded to, we have to be careful of blurring out white or settler privilege in our calls for unity. Because while we are all affected, we are affected in different ways and to different extents. The most unifying point of concern with Bills C-45 and C-38 is the removal of legislative protection of our natural environment, and that's no surprise. We all need clean air to breathe, clean water to drink, and clean soil out of which to grow our food. But in that analysis, we need to recognize that First Nation and Aboriginal communities will feel the effects much more than others. These communities depend much more than most on the direct use of the natural resources that surround them in order to sustain themselves. Also, polluting extractive industries and waste sites are located much nearer and in much greater numbers to these communities than to other communities. So that's one thing to keep in mind. And that's one thing to keep in mind about this common ground about environmental protection. Another common ground in the omnibus bill that are found is the opposition to Stephen Harper's disdain for democracy. And however, it's important to consider that while Stephen Harper denies a democratic voice to all those he claims to represent as Prime Minister of the Canadian state, he outright denies national recognition and rights of sovereignty to the Indigenous peoples of this land, which the Canadian Constitution affirms as per treaties signed. So it's also very important to consider that First Nation and Aboriginal communities have had to endure and suffer through centuries of attempts of genocide, assimilation, and forced poverty. The consequences of this are very apparent in statistics of health indicators, imprisonment, and education. In other words, while we do stand together, the fields of struggle and the stakes before us are uneven. And those of us in a different place with higher privilege need to recognize this, and we need to understand where our advantages come from. We're getting dry, apologies. And I've lost my place in my speech. So we can't say, well, this is a matter of the past. I can't take responsibility for this. On the contrary, we have to take responsibility for this, because this is the legacy which continues to shape the relationship between Indigenous peoples and the Canadian state. And if we refuse to take responsibility, then we cannot hope to fundamentally change the present and find true, honest, and genuine reconciliation, regardless of what happens to Stephen Harper and Bill C-45. This brings me to my second point that we need to keep in mind when creating common ground, and that is that we need to consider the deeper structures out of which Stephen Harper and Bill C-45 emerge. While we could and should remove Stephen Harper from office and repeal the legislative changes his government has made, and these would be tremendous victories with very concrete positive impacts on the lives of us all. While this could and should happen, it would still not be enough, because we would still be left with the colonial relationship between the Indigenous peoples of this country and the Canadian state. And this would still leave us with an economy that's structured to concentrate wealth in the hands of a few, and where the sustainability of a perpetual drive for profit is given priority over the sustainability and health of our natural environment. So let's take a moment to examine very simply how our economy is structured. We need money and resources, first off, to produce something that, through a sale, will allow us to make more money, so that we can then produce more and then acquire more money and more resources. This is the basic cyclic pattern that's always growing and expanding that constitutes the basic structure of our economy, a capitalist economy. So what I'd like to examine more closely in the context of Idle No More is where the initial money and resources come from to begin a capitalist cycle. If money and resources are needed to generate an initial production, then where does this initial money and resources come from? Today, if you were to start a business from the ground up, you would tap into banks and investors in order to get your startup capital, because they have accumulated this money and these resources over the course of the existence of our economy. But what about before banks and investors had a chance to accumulate? At the very beginning of the capitalist economy, this money and these resources had to be gotten somehow. And this somehow is through theft and dispossession. In Europe, this happened through the appropriation of land previously commonly managed by peasants. on this continent. This happened through the theft of land and resources previously used and considered a common good by the indigenous peoples here on this continent. So, forward back to today, where levels of production and consumption have grown so much that the levels of accumulated capital, money, and resources are no longer sufficient to keep driving the economy. So that's why we're seeing two things now. One, the increasing dependence on debt and even the sales of debt to keep these cycles going. And two, a whole new round of appropriation of startup capital through the privatization of whatever was not already privatized, including commonly held reserve land. The privatization of this land is in and of itself a goal, to dismantle remaining examples of commonly held land. But what's even more attractive for those seeking capital is that the privatization of this land, along with the removal of environmental protection through bills like C-45 and also free trade agreements, is that it creates the conditions to privatize and transport vast amounts of resources like oil, wood, minerals, and water to be sold for a continued expansion of the economy. These are resources which, whether on or off reserve, indigenous peoples have a claim to. So, if it's the economy that drives the continued erosion of territorial rights of the indigenous peoples on this continent, when we're talking about anti-colonialism, are we not inherently also talking about anti-capitalism? Can they be otherwise than one and the same in the struggle we face today? So, my point of view comes from the fact that I am, and speak on behalf of an organization that is anti-capitalist. Well, what the heck does that mean? That means that we recognize and identify a common root cause for the many forms of oppression, division, and inequality that exists in our society. Because our economy is structured to concentrate ownership and controls of the means to produce goods and services, inevitably inequality in wealth and resources occurs and fosters divisions among human beings in order to justify inequality. So, this is what we are against. And of course, the question which is thrown at someone who says they are anti-capitalist is, well, what are you for? Well, I can't pretend, and you can't expect of me, a single person or a small organization in Halifax, to devise an entire plan for a new global society. It's very easy to point at capitalism. It's all around us. But to point to something that isn't there yet is much more difficult. And yet, that is not a reason to not try and come together and explore and discuss and experiment building relationships and structures of governance that give true democratic collective power to all those concerned. Without a doubt, there is more to human potential than what we have now and what's been tried already, and we must give ourselves the opportunity to explore and discuss and experiment and come together collectively to find true democratic power. What we're seeing in Idle No More is a challenge to the status quo. The challenge is expressed in various ways and from varying points of view, but there remains a unifying no to the theft and polluting of land for profits that are not distributed evenly. And this challenge is being organized in ways where people are not depending on those claiming to be in charge, but rather taking things into their own hands. Now, as the movement evolves, it's important for us to talk through our differences and ensure that our debates on strategies and analysis are constructive, and that we don't fall prey to pressures of divisive tactics. This struggle, along with many of our other struggles, will create the conditions for us to imagine another world and to create it together. Thank you.
And finally, Professor Patricia Doyle talks about the importance of education to Aboriginal communities and Idle No More.
Thank you very much, and I'm really honored to be here tonight. I want to say, first of all, that not kids, I'm sorry. The youth! I love you guys. You're awesome. And I want to, my topic tonight, I'm just going to talk for a little bit. It's about Aboriginal education. And there's two ways that I look at, actually three. One is my own experience as a MCBAC student at Dalhousie. And when I walked in tonight and I've seen so many people here to support Idle No More, I just was overwhelmed with joy and hope. And the reason I say that is because I remember sitting in the sub 30 years ago, and five of us were sitting in the sub, drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes. and it was cool then. And when I think of how far we've come, it amazes me. And so that's the first thing that I thought about. The second thing is Aboriginal education has been one of the major tools of assimilation used by the government. And I've always said, you know, like Duncan Campbell Scott would say that we're going to continue, and he was the deputy superintendent of Indian Affairs, we're going to continue residential schools until there's not a single Indian left in the body politic. So education has always been used as a tool of assimilation. Residential schools. And I'm very tied into the issue of education because, first of all, my job, my experience, and the fact that I want to participate in the education of people about the issues that we face as Aboriginal people. I am Mi'kmaq. I am from Gololadec in Cape Breton. I'm from Maine. I was one of those migratory Mi'kmaq, and I am the only Mi'kmaq professor at Dalhousie that teaches on Indigenous issues, and the only way I can get to do that is if somebody offers me a job, like a course, to do that. So even at Dalhousie and at most universities, the issues of Aboriginal education, of our history, has not been considered important. And all you have to do is scroll the CBC comments to see how dumb, okay, I said it, dumb people are. We're all in this together. We are all in this together. And on Tuesday, the Federal Court of Canada just increased the number of Aboriginal peoples by almost 700,000. And I thought that was awesome. And I know there's debates about that. But the only way we can have a debate about these issues is if we have an education and we understand where we're coming from. And if what colonialism is about being invisible. I just did this lecture today. My class went pretty up on it. I would have to look at my notes. It's about being invisible. It's about negative stereotypes about us. It's about getting rid of us. And colonialism has been opposed by one thing, and that's resistance. And when I think of my ancestors, I think of my mother who went to residential school and still brought us up in a Mi'kmaq way, even though we weren't on the reserve all the time. That's the education that I hang on to. The other thing I have to say is I did an interview for CBC this morning, and they didn't want me to talk about law. And I thought, wait a minute, I get trained in law. I can talk all about law. Please let me do it. No, too complicated for the listening audience on CBC. A lot of the stuff people listening to CBC were smart, right? I only started listening to them myself like 15 years ago. I didn't even know. I did, and I like C100. But the thing is that the law is a tool that's been used by the colonizers to define us, to get rid of us, to take away our land, to take away our culture, our ceremonies. And now, what's happening is they're even taking away our right to attend esteemed institutions like Dalhousie University because they don't want to do what they have made the commitment to do. And it's their responsibility to pay for our education. They made that commitment. We didn't say, oh, please give us money. Like I read on the CBC the other day, gimme, gimme, gimme. No, it's not about that. The government made a commitment. We have an Aboriginal right to education, to funding from post-secondary education, and we have to take back our education so it's not simply used as a tool of assimilation. But you know what? Assimilation was trumped by racism. Because even if we try to be, even if I try to be a cute little lawyer, I'm still an Indian. And I have that mechanism. So I am saying right now, Aboriginal education, the government is trying to transfer the jurisdiction back to the provinces. The Mi'kmaq people have jurisdiction over our own education. There's two statutes that say that. They can't change that. And when I say about the law, Constitution Act, Section 52, Supreme Law of Canada, you can't have anything that's in conflict with that, or it's of no force and effect. Hello, Stephen, did you take constitutional law? I don't think so. At least not how it refers to us. So, I think it's really important when we talk about education. I'm going to try to be good. Is that we need education in this environment. I have 3 degrees, and I'm not saying that to brag. I'm saying that because it was really hard. It was so hard. Law school, But you know what made it difficult? It wasn't because I had a lack of brain power, it was because of the racism I experienced. That's what made it difficult. And in my job at Dalhousie, I try to mitigate that for people. I try to create a positive environment at Dalhousie. And things have changed. And I'm happy for those changes. So now I'm really rambling. The last, and this is the last thing I want to say. The world was supposed to end on December 21st. My son went to Guatemala and the Mayan elders told him, don't worry about it. It's like, okay, we won't worry about it. But the world did end in a way. Because something happened. And I think it is the creator, higher power, God, whatever we want to call that spiritual power that brought people together. And I support that power. I support the people that are involved in this movement. And our education, not only as getting our degrees and getting that part of it, we also deserve to have the education from our elders about our ceremonies. We need our land to do our ceremonies. We need our land to create space for all of us to live in a good way. I deserve to have the knowledge of my elders. I deserve that. And part of what Aboriginal education is about is to teach us how to be good Mi'kmaq men and women. And that is what we're about. So part of being that responsibility, part of having that responsibility is maybe it's getting a degree. Maybe it's doing something positive for your community. But it's also about our own Indigenous knowledge and tribal consciousness. And we cannot let that go. And to see the youth moving forward, not just from a political perspective, but from a spiritual foundation, is invigorating and hopeful. So, that, well, thank you. That means to stop. No. We have the right to educate our children. We have the right, if we want to come to Dalhousie, we have the right to do that. The federal government has taken that responsibility for funding us on, and they did it in 1969 when, like, most people had, like, grade 3, so it's like, wow, you can go to university. But that's where the My Transition Year program, I call it mine, because I feel like it's mine too. That's where that came from. And it's not because we're less than other people, it's because we didn't have the opportunity to get the same kind of mainstream education So TYP came into being, and we're still there. We're still teaching. We're still, it's really about negotiating what I call negotiating a cultural divide, because racism still exists. We still face that every day. And like I said on Tuesday, you know, people don't know the difference between a status or non-status Indian, so it doesn't, it's like, it doesn't really matter, because we're all together as Aboriginal people, whether it be Bancard or not, because that's the government's definition of who we are, and we have to take the power back, whether it's through, we have to take the power back to define ourselves, who we are and what we need to know and how we work with our elders and listen to our elders. That's our responsibility. And I really believe what someone said earlier, that it might be just our indigenous knowledge that helps save this world. Because the water is the lifeblood of Mother Earth. We all come from water. When you're in your mother's womb, you are in water. It's basic and fundamental. Those are the things that we have to learn so that we can move forward and take down Stephen Harper, because he's a, as I said, on the Big Bang Theory. Oh, he's a dictator. Well, why'd you call him that? Well, I just added Peter. Talk about colonialism and our history and our treaties and the spiritual foundation of where we come from. But I'm excited because it's an opportunity for me and for other people to learn. And I said, let's go forward, debate, create, form our truths, find all our truths together. And that to me is what our education is about, whether you're doing an MSc in biology, you're doing a law degree, or you're sitting, most importantly, at your elder's side, listening. When I listened to my mother tell me the stories, and she didn't even know she was doing it, and I didn't know she was doing it. Because colonialism would have killed us, except for our strength and our spiritual foundation. So that's what I want to say about education. I can do all the legal stuff if you want, but I don't feel like it right now. We have jurisdiction.
Sentence, P.S. The, talking about people defining us, that decision that came down from the Supreme Court says that we can now call ourselves Indians. A little note of history. Columbus got lost, but did not make us Indians. That's where he thought he was going. We are not Indians, we are indigenous peoples.
Thank you to the members of Solidarity Halifax, Idle No More, and to all the speakers for putting on such an amazing event. Music for this piece has been by A Tribe Called Red. Thank you to the members of Solidarity Halifax, Idle No More, and to all the speakers for putting on such an amazing event. Music for this piece has been by A Tribe Called Red.